the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. Brooke and I are here with a special guest, attorney Daniel Gibson, and we're going to be delving into impeachment, some of the history, some of the legal foundations and thought of impeachment. Why did the founders include it within our Constitution? We'll look at all that stuff and some of the contemporary things going on with President Trump. Brooke, Daniel, how's it going?
Going great. Glad to be here. Had a great time last time.
We are so glad to have you on again. This is going to be fun, especially because I have read through some of just the research you've done on this, and we've got a lot to cover, but I think it's just really interesting, meaty stuff that will help our audience understand really the history of impeachment and sort of look at what's going down right now in Congress and the showdown between the executive and the legislative branch and understand it better in light of history. So go ahead and start us off with a little bit, just a quick explainer of what is impeachment and where did it come from? Where did this idea come from?
So the idea is if we've got someone that we don't think is, or maybe we think is a threat to the nation or is doing a particularly bad job in government, the legislature, in this case Congress, has the authority to remove that person. And where this all started was in England, and a lot of American law comes from England because we were part of Great Britain until we got our independence. In England, the Parliament had the authority to remove counselors and advisors and people working for the king that they thought were doing something wrong, something that was against the national interest. So the first time they do this is in 1386. They remove the Earl of Stafford for not appropriating funds correctly. And actually, that's where the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors comes from. That's one of the things that he's accused of in Parliament. Hadn't turned up anywhere else, as far as we know of, but he was ultimately removed from office for that.
Okay, now you said high crimes and misdemeanors, and that's where this phrase came from. So what you're saying essentially is impeachment doesn't stem from necessarily an executive or some other political appointee or elected person breaking a law, but basically not complying with Congress, perhaps in our case, in a way that we think that they should or in a way Congress thinks they should.
Well, there's kind of this interesting interplay between what was happening in Great Britain and what's happening in the United States. So in Great Britain, that was certainly the case. There's all sorts of people that were removed or even capitally punished for what essentially amounted to contempt of Parliament, not doing what Parliament wanted them to do. At one point, the mayor of London refused to comply with something that Parliament said about the storage of arms in London, and he was impeached for that. The problem with that is when we come over here to the United States, the framers of the Constitution were very, very concerned with legislative power. So in Great Britain, Parliament can do whatever they want to. I mean, it is literally the law in the United Kingdom that if Parliament does it, it's constitutional. That's not the rule over here. So some of this precedent that we're looking at in the United Kingdom, there's a guy that gets impeached for giving the king medicine without a doctor's advice. I don't think that that necessarily carries over here. Number one, we don't have a king. And number two, Congress isn't supreme over the president and over the Supreme Court, like Parliament is supreme over the other branches in the United Kingdom.
So go ahead and going over to the United States, and so we're going to leave the across the pond stuff across the pond for a moment, and let's go ahead and talk about how an impeachment procedure goes forward here in the United States. How does it, what does it look like?
So it's looked different depending on the circumstances. So the first president of the United States that gets impeached is President Andrew Johnson, and he's president after Abraham Lincoln is assassinated. And unlike other more modern impeachments, they vote on, they being Congress, vote on impeaching him first, and then they write their articles of impeachment. That's not what's happened in other presidential impeachments. Like with Clinton and Nixon, there was an investigation, then they draw up articles, then they actually impeach the president.
Except that Nixon wasn't impeached, correct? Yeah. Okay.
So what typically happens is the House investigates, files articles of impeachment, sends the articles over to the Senate. The Senate then tries the case. And we have most of these impeachments are impeachments of judges. So in the 80s, there was a judge that was impeached, and he went all the way up to the Supreme Court saying, hey guys, I wasn't tried by the whole Senate. There's a Senate rule, Senate Rule 11, that says we're going to basically have a committee that's going to do their own investigation, and they're going to send us a report. And we'll have videos that we can watch of all of the people that are testifying and so on and so forth. But we really don't want to waste our time as a whole Senate doing this impeachment process. So he says, Constitution says I have to be tried by the whole Senate. I wasn't tried by the whole Senate. This is unconstitutional. United States Supreme Court says no luck. Basically, the Senate says, or the Constitution says, the Senate has the sole power to try impeachment. Sole power means just that. They can do the trial however they want to do the trial. And if you don't like it, you got to vote out your senators.
I got a question, Daniel. This may make you put on more of a political hat than a legal hat, but Andrew Johnson's impeachment obviously was very controversial. He was impeached in the House, and he was a one-vote victory for him in the Senate that acquitted him. Very controversial, obviously. But it kind of just from a historical perspective, has maybe put impeachment on a partisan trajectory, his whole impeachment. Do you feel like that just in the nature, we're in a very partisan era? You know, obviously there's been partisan eras in American history, but not too many that I think that are more partisan now. But do you feel like impeachment just in general has just taken on this partisan trajectory? I think the Nixon era was different because the Democrats, they had a heavy, majority in the House and at least a majority in the Senate. And so, you know, and a lot of conservatives didn't like Nixon anyways. So the political dynamics are different. But what kind of do you see as this partisan trajectory that's kind of come out of impeachment that may be just a very precarious time right now?
I think there's a lot of hand-wringing about how political and theatrical all of this impeachment stuff is. I don't think any of that would have caught the founding fathers or the framers of the Constitution by surprise. There's all sorts of statements in the Constitutional Convention, in the state ratifying conventions, in constitutional scholars from the early Republic to today, basically all of them saying, hey, this is a political process, not a judicial process. So I think they kind of expected, maybe not direct partisanship, but they certainly expected it to be a political decision. There's actually a Court of Appeals case from the D.C. Circuit that comes out and says that directly. Look, guys, this is not a judicial process. This is a political process. That case is In re Lindsay, and I think it's a 1991 case, but I don't remember right now. So as far as partisanship goes, I think that's baked into the process. That's one of the reasons why the Senate has a two-thirds majority requirement, because if you can get two-thirds of the Senate to agree on something, it's probably pretty bipartisan. So the framers sort of said, look, obviously the public can get carried away. Obviously this can be a big political football. So we're going to make the threshold really high in the Senate so that you have to at least convince some of the people in the president's own party or some of the president's own supporters that he's actually worth impeaching. So for instance, right now, if the Democrats want to impeach Donald Trump, they have to convince 20 Republican senators by most counts to vote for impeachment. That's a pretty high number.
Do you foresee or do you, I guess, discern that there are any issues now that the 17th Amendment has been passed? We've got senators that are popularly elected. What sort of dynamic does that play into impeachment? Do you think that that makes the Senate less inclined to impeach, given that they're popularly elected by these same people that elected the executive, or the Electoral College comes into play here? I know that's a very strange question and a nuanced answer, I'm sure, but are there any just thoughts initially on that?
That's a really interesting question. I think some of the constitutional scholars of the 19th century sort of grappled with that. You know, again, in Britain, the House of Lords, which is where the trial would take place, you can guess by the name, those people haven't historically been elected. They were sort of intentionally aristocratic, so they were separated from the people. And under the Constitution, at least as originally written, the Senate was sort of supposed to be that way. I think there's probably some partisan pressure here. From a political strategy perspective, I was a little surprised that there weren't more articles of impeachment. I think with both Johnson, you know, Johnson had 11 articles of impeachment. With Clinton, there were 4 articles of impeachment. Only 2 were proceeded on in the House. So it sort of helps to have this broad brush. Well, there's 11 things. Maybe you can vote in favor of 5 and against 6 and give yourself some political cover. I think it certainly changes the political math. As far as changing the law on impeachment, I really don't think it changes that much.
I think another question is, just from a, this may help listeners, from a necessity standpoint, why do you think impeachment was included in the Constitution? I mean, obviously, if someone's taking bribes, and let's say they're caught on camera, like you had members of Congress, I don't know how long ago, maybe 20, 30 years ago, where there were actually members of Congress caught on bribes, taking bribes from Saudi officials, and there's been different cases throughout history. But what's the importance of impeachment just in our Constitution from a separation of powers perspective and from just accountability? And obviously, you know, our system, unlike maybe Great Britain, where you have a king and a sovereign, and at least in the past, you know, was in some cases above the rule of law. But here in the United States, you know, no one's above the rule of law. So why is this important in our kind of founding documents and just sort of the procedural aspects for accountability and separation of powers?
Yeah, if you look at the folks that have been impeached historically, most of the time there's really no question about whether or not they should be impeached. There was a judge fairly early on in the United States that was impeached that was well known to be a drunkard. He said some crazy things. He might have actually even been crazy. Mm-hmm. There's judges that have been impeached for taking bribes. There's judges that have been impeached for lying in their FBI background check to become a judge. And that's nothing new. Charles II, when he was king, basically had a deal with the King of France, where the King of France was paying him money not to get involved in wars on the European continent. So the Founding Fathers and the framers of the Constitution definitely knew that there could be these sorts of problems, and they wanted a check that was more frequent than every 4 years on the power of the president. Now, if our president basically pledges allegiance to a foreign government or starts taking money from a foreign government, we need to be able to get that guy out as soon as possible. And I'm certainly not saying our president right now has done that, but that was sort of the thought that the framers had in mind when they were writing this. And that actually gets to sort of the original constitutional text here. When they were writing the Constitution, originally it just said treason or bribery. And George Mason comes along and says, hey, I want it to say treason, bribery, or maladministration.
That can mean anything.
Yeah. James Madison comes back and says maladministration is so broad, you're basically getting a system where our president is prime minister. He's just there whenever Congress wants him to be there. So that's when they came in and put in the language high crimes and misdemeanors. And there's sort of 2 phrases that recur over and over again. There's a phrase, gross abuse of office, that a lot of the framers of the Constitution used. And then they also talk about high crimes and misdemeanors as having a limited and technical meaning. So it's something more than maladministration, something on the same level as treason or bribery, but beyond that, kind of ambiguous even still.
So it seems that there are 3 different, essentially, verdicts that the Senate can reach after the House is impeached and they have conducted the trial, and that's guilty, not guilty, and innocent. Is that correct?
Yeah, I had kind of sort of noted that. And really, it's very important, I think, for people who aren't lawyers to understand the difference between those 3 things. Typically, when the Senate votes on impeachment, they vote guilty or not guilty. The reason why I include innocent as a 3rd category is because a lot of times we think not guilty and innocent are the same thing. Guilty means you definitely did it. Innocent means you definitely didn't do it. Not guilty kind of exists somewhere between the 2 of those things. Every criminal defense attorney knows that someone can have done it, they can have done the crime and still be legally not guilty because the process was wrong. And I think that was part of the case in Andrew Johnson's impeachment. Andrew Johnson was not a great president. He was a Southern Democrat. He was probably racist. He was definitely trying to stop Congress from doing Reconstruction, which is basically giving rights to African Americans after the Civil War. They sort of got him on a legal technicality, but he really should have been removed from office. And I think the way that Congress went about trying to remove him from office is ultimately why he got acquitted on impeachment, even though it was only by one vote. Because the Senate looked at it and said, look, this is a bad guy, but we don't like how you went after him.
Jumping up to modern day, help me understand, and maybe some listeners out there, hopefully they know this better than I do. I just haven't paid attention to some of the latest kind of jockeying and power plays. But why is Nancy Pelosi not sending up the article of impeachment to the Senate? I mean, what's her strategy there? I saw that she had received advice from Lawrence Tribe, who's a famous attorney, on not to send those articles, at least right away. I mean, what's going on there? What's her power play there?
You know, I think that's a really good question. I'm really not certain. I think we can be certain of this. Whether or not you like him, Mitch McConnell is a very effective leader. When it comes time to get the Senate to do or not do something, Mitch McConnell has proven himself repeatedly that he can get butts in seats, he can get the votes where he needs them. So I think if you're a House Democrat, you're looking at the impeachment process and you're saying, guys, we really didn't get a whole lot of public support. The numbers didn't change a whole lot during House impeachment. We're going to send this over to the Senate. Mitch McConnell knows how to run his Senate. They're going to vote to acquit, almost certainly. We haven't convinced 20 Republican senators. So if we send this over, this is a losing proposition, and this is just going to make us look worse. So maybe the idea is we wait on this long enough, we can sort of keep it out there. Maybe we can add more articles of impeachment. Maybe we can get more evidence. Maybe we can get the Senate to agree, or we can pull off a few of the moderate Republican senators to change the rules in our favor. As the rules currently are, what would probably happen is the Senate would refer it to a committee that would investigate, same as they did with Walter Nixon, who's the judge that complained about all that in the 80s. And there wouldn't be a whole lot of theatrics. There'd just be a Senate vote. And I think Mitch McConnell is licking his lips to have a Senate vote, because I think we all know how that will turn out.
So I just want to do a little mental exercise here among us three, and I'm curious as to what you all think a Mike Pence presidency would look like should impeachment go a way that we totally did not anticipate.
Gosh, I just don't think there's any way that Donald Trump is going to be impeached. So removed from office, I should say. He's already been impeached. But yeah, there's just... I don't think Mike Pence, having met the guy before, I like him. He's a very likable guy. He's obviously well known within the Republican Party. He's the vice president, but I don't think he would be as effective as Donald Trump. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he actually started out in state policy work, at least from a political perspective. He was a president of a think tank in Indiana. And, you know, obviously from a policy perspective, he knows the right things to say. He's got a good conservative record when he was in the House. He was in leadership for a time in the U.S. House. He obviously would be a very competent president, but I just don't think there's any way that Donald Trump's going to be removed from office. He may not be reelected, but there's no way that he's going to be removed from office.
I think there's two really interesting questions, and I'm totally going to answer a different question to the one you asked, so I'll own it right now. Number one, if he's removed from office by the Senate, do they disqualify him from holding office in the future? I think the answer to that is no. So does he then run for re-election? And how does him being impeached affect him running for re-election? And I could see a possibility that him being removed from office actually helps him.
No, I think that's true.
The other big question is what happens to every other Republican that's running for office? If Trump is removed from office, you know, what does that mean for Dan Forrest? What does that mean for our judges and our state representatives here in North Carolina that are running under the Republican banner? Does that hurt them when they're getting reelected?
Yeah, I think there's a political point to make here is that the Republican Party has been mightily united for all the kind of chaos there is with Donald Trump, you know, whether it's on Twitter or just some of the things he says, which, you know, I come across, I don't know these people he's talking about. And, you know, my feelings are hurt a little bit sometimes, you know, like, wow, I can't believe he just said that and he's the president of the United States. But, you know, the Republican Party has been united behind this guy. I mean, there's not one Republican in the House. I know Justin Amash is an independent and he's got his own personal grudge with Trump. Trump's pretty much probably ruined Amash's career, at least maybe definitely short term. I don't know about long term, but, you know, he is someone that has their Republican base united behind him. He's got the Republican legislators, the members of Congress all united behind him. And it's just really fascinating to see because, you know, when you look at Trump 10 years ago, you would have not thought this is going to be the leader of the Republican Party. In fact, he was more chummy with Democrats and so on and so forth and in every way before he actually jumped into those Republican primaries. But, you know, it's just to me, it's amazing how united they are. And I think that's what gives Trump a lot of his strength, not just the cult of his personality, but that he does have the Republican Party behind him 100% in this. And that I think that helps him politically through all this.
I think that's one big difference from other impeachments. When Congress moved to impeach Andrew Johnson, he was already really unpopular and they already knew why they were really impeaching him. You can talk about the Tenure in Office Act and Edward Stanton and all that stuff. They were impeaching him because he wasn't doing Reconstruction how Congress wanted him. With Nixon and Clinton, we found out more from the House and the Senate investigations. So we started out with a suspicion, and that suspicion was confirmed, and we found smoking gun evidence in those cases. I think the House here started its investigation with the idea that they would find evidence like that on Donald Trump. Because if you told me 9 months ago, if you dig enough into Donald Trump, do you think we'll find something? I probably would have said, yeah, you know, he doesn't seem like the most upstanding guy. I think if you gave me enough time and enough latitude, I could find something we could pin on him. Yeah, especially if I was a House Democrat, I'd take that bet. But I think they've lost their wager. The smoking gun hasn't come out. We're still talking about the same evidence we were talking about before the House began its impeachment process, and it hasn't produced bipartisan support. And that's really what the founders intended, the framers intended in the Constitution, was something that would be so clear, even the president's supporters would say, you gotta go because of this. And that just hasn't happened here.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think there's evidence that there would be Republicans if there were, you know, like you said, the smoking gun. I mean, you have Susan Collins, who's kind of come out and said, you know, I'm open to witnesses testifying in the Senate. But I think you'd have more criticism. You certainly have people in the House who would be willing to buck Trump. There's people in the Northeast still that are Republicans that I think that might be willing to buck Trump if it was, you know, if there was something there. But I think this Republican unity has really, like I said before, just completely played to his advantage. I mean, you see him constantly tweeting out 95-96% approval rating amongst Republicans for whatever that's worth. I don't know what poll he's citing. But, you know, he clearly has the backing of the Republican Party establishment, and he has the backing of the grassroots. And so until that changes, I don't think there's any political way that, you know, because this is a political impeachment, that the dynamics for Trump are going to change.
Yeah, and you really see that, I think, with the articles of impeachment that were passed. The first article really has a lot to do with what we already knew, this Ukraine telephone call that everyone is reading a different way. I don't think it looks great for the president, right. But seriously, it's President Trump. You're going to hang on President Trump's words. He is famously, you know, not exactly artful with his words. You know, he's not the clearest speaker, especially when he speaks in person. So I think to try to hang his intent based on his words is maybe not the best thing for Trump.
Agreed.
And then Article 2 of impeachment is obstruction of Congress. I think a lot of people voted for Donald Trump because they thought he was going to obstruct things in Washington.
Drain the swamp, right?
Yeah. Whether or not that's legally grounds for impeachment is a really, really interesting question. There's this kind of weird statute that I'm just going to sort of reference in passing. Y'all can Google it at home if you want to. It's 18 U.S.C. 1505, which is obstruction of a proceeding before departments, agencies, and committees. Basically makes it a federal crime to obstruct a congressional proceeding, among other things. So maybe there's some legal basis for that. I'm not a big fan of this statute, honestly. It's not very well written. There's some cases saying, hey, this might not be super constitutional. And honestly, part of our political process, the branches are designed to obstruct one another. That's called separation of powers. And every executive that I know of has at some point in time done something that is obstructive to Congress. If we were Great Britain and Parliament was sovereign, obstruction of Parliament would be grounds for impeachment. But we're not Great Britain. We're a very different constitutional system. And I think if Congress is mad that the president didn't follow subpoenas, didn't allow witnesses to testify, they should go to court or they should hold those people in contempt of Congress. And those are both things that they can totally do. But instead, they've chosen to impeach. And I don't see a whole lot of public support, especially for that second article of impeachment, because it is kind of shaky. And I don't think it's a precedent we really want to be setting as a country.
Those are some great thoughts and insights into the history of impeachment.
Pence.
Oh, I asked you all that question.
She no, doesn't President, want to answer.
President Pence, no, as a female, I wonder if any other females are allowed to actually have meetings with him because of the Pence rule. So that's just kind of a one-off thought there. But he does seem like a very, very nice man. So anyways, though, let's go ahead and wrap this up. This has been very fascinating, so thank you, Daniel. And if you have any questions or feedback about this, feel free to send us an email at radio@nccivitas.org. Also, don't forget to sign up for our Conservative Leadership Conference, which is coming up in April. There are still early bird tickets available, I do believe. So if you go to civitasclc.org or .com, you should be able to access those tickets. And thank you again for listening and joining us. Feel free to leave your reviews on iTunes, and we will catch you all next week.